All right, good afternoon, everyone. So first of all, I really want to thank Stewie and the law offices of Baker Donaldson for hosting this Lunch and Learn series. I always say when I love coming down here because the view is just magnificent. It makes me want to take off the rest of the day. I don't know how anyone here is productive with a view like that. But I really want to thank Stewie very much for hosting this and for the beautiful lunch. And a welcome to everyone. It's always, I say, personally inspirational when you see a group of professionals who take out time in the middle of their day to be able to learn a little bit of Torah, you know, while we're all pursuing our material pursuits, material responsibilities, to see a group of people who take a little bit of time, carve out a little bit of time for some spirituality. And with that, originally I was going to focus a bit more on the Yom Tov of Shavuos. But then, you know, over the couple of shiurim, a couple of classes that I've been giving over this time of year, I've been focusing on the Megillah Asuros. So, you know, of course, again, Shavuos, we read this incredible story of a woman by the name of Ruth. And again, there's a variety of different reasons as to why we read the Megillah. What's the purpose of it? On a most basic level, so remember again, the Megillah highlights really David HaMelech, King David's yichus, his genealogy. Rus is his great-grandmother. David HaMelech is born on Shavuos, passes away on Shavuos, it's the yard site. And as such, we go ahead and we read this on Shavuos. A variety of other... Rus was a convert, she was a Gioras. On the Yom Tov of Shavuos, when we go ahead and we receive the Torah, we all undergo some type of conversion process as well. But embedded in the Megillah are a variety of other incredible messages as well, which are important for the Yom Tov of Shavuos and important really for life in general. So I want to share with you one of these ideas. Take a look at number one. So just by way of background, so remember again, the Megillah begins with the story of a man by the name of Elimelech. Elimelech goes with his wife and his two sons, Mahlon and Kilion, his wife Naomi, his two sons Mahlon and Kilion. They leave the land of Israel in the midst of regional famine, and they relocate to the fields of Moab. Mahlon and Kilion, there might be more sheets that went down. I know that I brought enough. They might have accumulated somewhere. Mahlon and Kilion go ahead and marry two Moabite girls. To make a very long story short, Mahlon and Kilion die. Naomi, Elimelech dies. Naomi decides to go ahead and go back to the land of Israel, and her daughter-in-law Rus follows along. Arpa goes back to her family in Moab. Rus follows Naomi back to the fields of the land of Israel. So this number one picks up with Rus and Naomi, two widows. One a much older widow, one a much younger widow, come back to Eretz Yisrael after the land of Israel, after the famine has subsided. So something amazing happens. Naomi and Rus come back to the land of Israel, and as they enter back into the land, everyone is assembled. Everyone is assembled, and they go ahead and they say, wow, is that Naomi? Remember when Naomi had left the land of Israel a number of years earlier, first of all, she was younger, she had an intact family. Now she comes back, and literally, she's all alone. She has no husband. Nebuchadnezzar, unfortunately, tragically, both of her sons have predeceased her. So tragedy, life adversity as a way of changing and aging people. So she comes back and people say, is that really Naomi? So interestingly enough, if you look at number two, I put a lot more on the sheet than we're going to cover here today. But if you take a look at number two, so the Jerusalem Talmud says, why is everyone gathered? Why is everyone gathered? In other words, it almost sounds like when you read the Megillah, it sounds like everybody's gathered waiting for Naomi to come back. As far as they knew, Naomi was never going to come back. She had left the land of Israel for good. So why is everyone gathered? So amazingly enough, the Talmud Yerushalmi says something else. Jerusalem Talmud explains, they were coming back from a funeral. Whose funeral? The wife of Boaz. Boaz is the other major character in the Megillah. He's actually a relative of Naomi, the man who at the end of the story, I don't want to spoil the whole story, but the one who at the end of the story marries Rus, becomes the great-grandfather of the Davidic line. So if you look at number two, Efshar Kain Kol Karta Misbala Begay Naomi, everybody is gathered to welcome back Naomi. What's happening over here? Elo Ishto Shaboaz Mesa. The wife of Boaz had passed away, Boaz Sahayom. So remember again, Boaz was the leader of the generation. As such, when his wife passed away, there was a funeral. There was a funeral. You know, it's almost amazing. You know, you hear the news out of Eretz Yisrael, out of Israel today, that President Rivlin's wife passed away. When a head of state's wife passes away, so obviously everyone comes to pay their respect. So everyone was gathered for this funeral. So you have to understand the confluence of events. So everyone is together. When we say everyone, the city of Beis Lechem, of Bethlehem, which is where pretty much Jewish nobility, royalty, the upper echelon of society lived, everyone was gathered for this funeral. And amazingly enough, as they're on their way back from the cemetery, who do they see walking back into the land of Israel? None other than Naomi and her daughter-in-law, Ruth. So this is incredible. Skip a little bit to number 3 now. So just keep that in mind. So they come back. Ula Naomi moda li'isha ishki barchas. Remember again, so at that point, when they meet each other, so when Naomi and Ruth walk back in, there's an uproar because people can't believe that Naomi is back. They have no idea what's happened. She looks so dramatically different. She says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Call me bitterness, because life has become overwhelmingly bitter for me." Fast forward a little bit. Number 3, Ruth and Naomi resettle back in the land of Israel. They are living in abject poverty. They have nothing. Naomi, remember Elimelech, Naomi's deceased husband, was very wealthy. They're one of the wealthiest families in Beis Lechem Yehuda, in Bethlehem, but they lost all of their money. So Naomi comes back, she's broken, she's poor, she has nothing. So Naomi tells Ruth, so the Megillah records a piece of information, which is that Naomi had a very powerful and rich relative, a man by the name of Boaz. So amazingly enough, just so you appreciate all the events that are happening, Naomi and Ruth come back into the land of Israel just as Boaz was burying his wife. Naomi's relative is Boaz. The issue is they're poor. So the only way for them to live is through gleaning, through charity. So one of the important agricultural laws that we have is our concepts called leket shichacha and peah, which essentially mean that when you are farming and you are harvesting your field, if something drops, you have to leave it for the poor. You're obligated to go ahead and leave a corner of your crop uncut for the poor. If when gathering the sheaves, you end up forgetting something in the field, you have to leave it there for the poor. So Naomi tells her daughter-in-law, Ruth, "We have nothing to eat, there's nothing. Go out to the fields. Go out to the fields and collect some food." What doesn't Naomi tell Ruth? What doesn't she tell her? Where to go. She doesn't tell her where to go. She says, "Just go, just go." Ruth goes, and amazingly enough, what happens? Number 4, Vatelech Vatova Vatilakit Basada Acharea Kozim. So she goes to the field. And whose field does she happen to show up? Vayikar Mikra Chelk, I'm number 4. Vayikar Mikra Chelkas Hasada Leboaz Eshem Mishpachas Elimelech. Whose field does she show up in? Amazingly enough, whose field? Boaz. So remember again, Rus has no idea that she is related to Boaz, has no idea that Boaz is a close relative of her mother-in-law and of Ruth's deceased husband. She has no idea. She just goes out to the field to glean because they have nothing to eat. And which field does she have? Now, the wording over here is very interesting. Vayikar Mikra. Vayikar Mikra means what? Mikra means coincidence. She happens upon the field of Boaz. She wasn't looking for it. She just, so you understand the context? It's amazing when you see the way God runs his world. You know, the beauty of this story is we get to see all the stuff that's happening behind the scenes. So Ruth and Naomi come back to Israel literally on the day when Boaz buried his wife. Ruth needs to glean in order to support herself and her frail mother-in-law. Whose field does she show up in totally by accident? The field of Boaz. Just as an aside, it's actually interesting, the Malbim points out over here that you see sometimes when God needs something to occur, he expedites the process. He fast tracks it. So where do we see, where is the first time we see God fast track a process? So this is amazing. The first time we see it is in Parshas Chayisara. And the Malbim points this out in number 5. So what happens in Parshas Chayisara? Avraham dispatches his servant Eliezer to find a wife for Yitzchak. Eliezer devises a plan. Remember, what's his plan? Right? I'm going to go to the well and ask a girl for a drink. Not ask a girl out for a drink. Ask a girl for a drink. I'm going to ask her for a drink. And if she agrees to give me a drink and also to water my flock of camels, that's the girl for Yitzchak. So remember again, if you're Eliezer, so you're thinking to yourself, you better have cleared your calendar, right? Because the truth is, to be able to find this girl is going to take some time. The first girl that Eliezer encounters at the well was none other than the woman who would become the matriarch Rivka, Rebecca, right? The first girl he meets. So the Malbim points out that sometimes when God is very eager for something to occur, he kind of things will always occur the way God wants them to occur, but very often they take time. When God is eager for something to occur, he fast-tracks it. He fast-tracked Eliezer finding Rivka, and he fast-tracks the introduction between Boaz and Rus. Rus at some point in time would have met Boaz. Why would she have met Boaz? Because if she's poor and if she's gleaning, it's only a matter of time until she reaches the field of the wealthiest landowner in the area. But it just happens to be that the first field she gets to is none other than the field ultimately of Boaz. So she comes to the field. Take a look at number 6. Vine Boaz ba mi beis lechem. Boaz came from Beis Lechem. He was out doing whatever he was doing. He says to the reapers, to the workers in the field, God is with you, or God be with you. And they respond back to him, God should bless you. And then Boaz calls over one of the workers, and he says, excuse me, who is that girl? Who is that girl in the field? So the worker responds, "Vayan hanar hanitzav ala kotshim, vayomer nara moavia hi, ashava im Naomi mistei Moav." So the worker says, "Oh, that girl, that's the Moabite girl who came back with Naomi from the fields of Moab." The worker doesn't know Ruth's first name, but everyone knows who she is, because it was quite dramatic that this young widow decided to accompany her mother-in-law back to a foreign land. So the reaper says to Boaz, that girl, that's the girl who accompanied her mother-in-law from the field of Moab. Now, interestingly enough, all of the commentaries ask a very simple question, which is, what's intriguing about this verse? What's intriguing about Boaz's behavior? It's interesting that he's inquiring about this young lady. There is a significant age difference between Boaz and Rus. Boaz's fields must have been filled with people who were going ahead and collecting from the gleanings. After all, he's one of the richest men in the area. There's never a shortage of impoverished people. There are always people in his field. So it's interesting to note that he specifically inquired regarding this young lady. So there are a number of different approaches to understand it. The Vilna Gaon, the Gra, we're not going to go into it, but I put it on your sheet if you want to look at it. The Vilna Gaon in number 7 espouses his own idea. But if you take a look at number 8, the Gemara Maseches Shabbos gives a very intriguing insight. The Gemara says, Vayomer Boaz lenaaro hanitzav ala kosun lemi hanaaro azos, v'chi darko shel Boaz lishol benaara. So the Gemara, the Talmud is a little bit intrigued by this. Is it appropriate for Boaz to be inquiring about this woman in his field? In other words, the Gemara assumes that obviously there's something that caught his eye about this young woman. And we would assume that looking at the simple pshat, it sounds like maybe she was beautiful, maybe she was attractive. That's what caught Boaz's eye. Is that befitting someone of Boaz's stature that ultimately he inquires about this young woman in his field? It's just intriguing. It's just not something we would expect from someone of Boaz's stature. Remember again, Boaz is not just a wealthy guy. Boaz is the religious leader, one of the spiritual religious leaders of his generation. So the notion that he would be inquiring about a young woman gleaning in his field is interesting, which leads the Talmud to say something amazing. Look at number 8. Second line, number 8. I'm Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, Divar Chachma Ra'aba. He saw something wise about this young woman. In other words, he saw something intriguing and different about her, specifically regarding her behavior. What did he see? Number 1, Shnei Shibalin Lakta, Shlosha Shibalin Eina Lakta. She only collected 2 stalks, not 3 stalks. There's an interesting halach, an interesting detail when it comes to the tithes for the poor. If you drop two stalks, right? If you're the owner of the field, you drop two stalks, you have to leave it on the ground and you can't pick it up. If you drop three, you're permitted to go back and pick it up. You leave two sheaves, you have to leave it there. Three sheaves, you can go back and pick it up. So interestingly enough, what Boaz saw is that this young woman was very careful to only collect the things she was entitled to. Meaning one would have to imagine that when you have groups of people collecting tithes in your field, not every pauper was meticulous about what he or she took. And there were definitely people who took more than they were entitled to take. He saw that this girl was exceptionally vigilant and diligent in making sure that she only took what she was allowed to take. If there are two stalks, she would take it. If there were three stalks, which meant the owner of the field was entitled to go back and collect that which she had left there, she would not take it. What else did he see? B'masnisa tana, davar tznius ra'asaba. He saw incredible modesty in her. Omedes mu'umad, nofeles miyushab. The way she would collect the stalks, she would just make sure to do so in a modest manner, either standing or sitting, depending ultimately on the positioning of the stalk. He saw incredible modesty in her. The Talmud actually goes on. There's actually another opinion of the Talmud that says, is actually quite fascinating, that the way it used to work is, essentially, you would go ahead and you would walk into the field. She's just like gleaning 101. You'd walk into the field. You'd walk through the field to the far end and then walk back. So what paupers often did is they would walk through, collect what they wanted to collect, and then walk back and collect anything that was left. Rus didn't do that. She first walked to the far end of the field and then only collected on the way back. What's the logic there? Less to carry. You don't have to carry that which you collect on the way there back as well. Therefore, she's only carrying. So the common denominator amongst all the opinions is that Boaz saw an incredible wisdom. An incredible wisdom. But more than just a wisdom, a seder. He saw a sense of order with this young girl. We're going to pause here for just a moment and I'll show you something amazing. Fast forward a couple of generations to Rus's great-great-great-grandson. Her great-grandson was a young man by the name of David. David HaMelech. David HaMelech wanted more, King David wanted more than anything to do what? To build the temple. But he was not allowed to do so for a variety of different reasons. So he did the next best thing. He composed the music to be sung in the temple. He composed the music for the Levitic choir. We call that music today Sefer Tehillim, the Book of Psalms. The Book of Psalms was really written as musical compositions to be sung in the temple by the Levitic choir. So King David writes something amazing in Tehillim. And by the way, not our topic for today, but it is incredible to see how so much Davidic wisdom comes from the Alter Baba, right? So much Davidic wisdom comes from his great-grandmother. Whether David knew that he got this from his great-grandmother from Rus, or it was just part of his genetic, his spiritual DNA, so many of the pearls of wisdom that King David espoused were the same things. Rus never espoused them. She lived them. She modeled them. So watch this. King David writes in number 9. This is chapter 15, Perek Tes Vav and Tilim. Mizmor le David. Song of David, Hashem miagor be'ohalecha miyishkon bahar kodshecho. Who will sojourn in your tent? Who will dwell upon your holy mountain? Now, without getting into what these terms mean specifically about sojourning in tents and living on holy mountains, on a most basic level, what does it represent? See, a lot of us, well, let's take it differently. What's the greatest challenge of spirituality? If we're honest with ourselves, the greatest challenge of spirituality is... Oh, Baruch Hashem, no one here struggles with spirituality. Incredible. Fine, I'll be the one. Right? One of the greatest struggles of the child is consistency. Is consistency. Is being consistent. And the problem we often have with consistency is consistency often bespeaks a fundamental lack of commitment. Meaning, at the end of the day, if I'm honest about my relationship with God, if I were to talk with God about our relationship, it kind of goes something like this. God, I love you very much. You are the center of my universe. I love you more than words could say, but I think we should see other people. In other words, I'm not ready to settle down yet. You're the best God out there, but I'm young. It's a big world out there. I love you. I want to be clear. I love you. I'm just not ready to commit. It sounds strange when you say it, but at the end of the day, when you're really committed to something, right? Think about this for just a moment. If you want your marriage to work, right? If a husband says to his wife, you know what? I'm going to be the best husband on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and alternate Fridays. Like, that's what I'm putting into this. The rest of the time, I'm out. I'm on my own, right? But so that marriage, of course, any relationship is going to last, needs commitment. We struggle with our relationship with God because often there's a fundamental lack of commitment. We're often not consciously aware of that, but subconsciously, that's what's unfolding. So King David says, who is the one who wants to dwell in the tent of God, to dwell on the mountain? Dwelling in the tent, living on the mountain, represents commitment, represents consistency. I'm living with God, not just visiting, not just showing up here and there. I'm living on the mountain. I'm living in the tent. How do you achieve a level of religious and spiritual consistency in life? So King David gives us part of the answer. He says, Holech tamim upoel tzedek. He who walks, so it's interesting, the translation over here is uprightly. Tamim very often is translated as perfection, which it can't be perfection because God never demands perfection. It often just means simplicity. That to have a meaningful relationship with God, to a certain degree, you have to be simple. You have to give him your love and your commitment and recognize that there will be many things that you will not understand over the journey of life. But I want to draw your attention to is that next underlined phrase, Ufoel tzedek. You have to be one who works righteousness. So on a most basic level, what does it mean to work righteousness? What does it sound like? Do good deeds. Do good deeds. That you want to go ahead and you want a relationship with God, you have to engage in chesed. You have to engage in acts of kindness. So if you look at number 10, the Gemara says something amazing. The Gemara says, Poel tzedek means something a little bit different. Poel tzedek means, what does it mean to affect righteousness? Literally, Paul means to labor. Tzedek, we're translating as righteousness, but it could also translate as how? Tzedek, justice, or correctness. So the Gemara says, you want to know an example of that? Like Abba Chilkiah. Who is Abba Chilkiah? So I want to show you an incredible story. Take a look at number 11. So the Talmud over here says in Maseches Tanis as follows. Abba Chilkiah, Bar Berei Dechoni HaMa'agel Hava. Who is Abba Chilkiah? Abba Chilkiah was the grandson of Choni HaMa'agel. We're all familiar with Choni HaMa'agel. Choni HaMa'agel is the Choni, the circle drawer. Right? Choni was the guy who drew, when there was a drought in the land of Israel, Choni drew a circle and he said, he gave God an ultimatum. Don't try this at home. He gave God an ultimatum. He said, God, I'm not leaving the circle until you bring rain. And amazingly enough, it rained. It rained. So Abba Chilkiah was a grandson of Choni HaMa'agel. Listen to this incredible story. V'chi mitzarech alma l'mitra. The English is on the next page as well. V'chi mitzarech alma l'mitra. Havi mishadri abana l'gabeyo b'ayrachmi. V'aisi mitra. Abba Chilkiah had an incredible power of prayer. And whenever the world needed rain, the rabbis would dispatch messengers to Abba Chilkiah and tell Abba Chilkiah, please daven on behalf of the people of Israel that there should be rain. Watch this story. Zimna chade itzrich amal mitra, shadir abanon zuga dir abanon lagabe lemibay rachami dinesi mitra. One time there was a drought, the world needed rain, and so the rabbis sent a pair of scholars to Abba Chilkiah to ask him to daven for rain. Okay. Azul abe, save lo ashkehu. They went to the house of Abba Chilkiah. He wasn't home. So they ultimately, they found him. He wasn't home. They found him in the field. And he was farming in the field. So the rabbis came to the field. They told Abba Chilkiah, Shalom Aleichem. Right? Hello. But he did not respond. So what happens? They wait for him an entire day. So the workday was over. Abba Chilkiah put his cloak on one shoulder and put his shovel and his farming utensils on a different shoulder. Okay. And he didn't explain anything. I'm sorry. the entire journey, the entire trip back home, Abba Chilkiah did not put on his shoes. Kimati lemaya siye masane. But when he got to a river, a body of water, he put his shoes on. Kimata lehizmi vihigi, when he got to a row of thorn bushes, talinhu lemane, he pulled up his cloak, his tunic. Kimata lemasa, nafka devisu laape kimekashta. When he came to the city, the edge of the city, his wife came out to greet him, and she was all adorned. She was dressed beautifully and wearing her jewelry. Kimata lebeise, when he came to his house, alas devisu bereisha. His wife went in the house first. Vahadra ayal ihu. Then Abba Chilkiah went in. Vahadra ayli rabbanon. And then only afterwards did the rabbis enter in. The Talmud tells a couple of other pieces over here. Ultimately, I'll tell you what happens in the rain for just a moment. So ultimately, again, what happens? Abba Chilkiah knows that the rabbis are there to ask him to pray for rain. He does not want anyone to think that he is righteous. So he tells his wife, you and I both know why the rabbis are here. Let's excuse ourselves for a moment. Go up to the attic. You go to your corner and pray. I'll go to my corner and pray. And the rain will come. So they come back downstairs. And by the time they come back downstairs, the rain had already come. So Abba Chilkiah, feigning ignorance, says, I'm sorry, my dear guest. Tell me, why did you come? To which the two rabbis said, come on, Abba Chilkiah. We know exactly what's going on. And we know that you and your wife brought the rain. But before we get into the rain, we have a number of questions for you. You are one strange guy. Because we've been with you the entire day, and you do a whole bunch of stuff that looks really strange. Do you mind if we ask you a couple of questions about your behavior? He said, sure. So they go through the entire day. So what happens? So I'll tell you this outside. So they say to him, why is it that when we said hello to you in the middle of the field, right, when we came and you were farming, you didn't answer us? So listen to this. Abba Chilkiah says, "Schir yomana, I am a day laborer, and when I am working, my time belongs to my employer, and right, billable hours, right? My time belongs to my employer, and as such, I have no right to take away time from my employer and greet you." What an incredible honesty. Honestly, I'm on the clock. And when I'm on the clock, I don't have a right even for a moment to give you a greeting and take away time from my employer. I said, fine. Why is it on the way home, when you finished, when your day was over, you put your cloak on one shoulder and your farming utensils on the other shoulder? It would have made more sense to what? Put the cloak on the shoulder and put the farming utensils on the shoulder so that what? It buffers a little bit between your shoulder and the farming utensils. It says, it's not my cloak. Abba Chilkiah was terribly impoverished. It's a borrowed cloak. I borrowed it to wear it. I didn't borrow it to use it as a cushion for the farming utensils. Abba Chilkiah, why is that the whole way you're walking, you walk barefoot, yet when you get to the water, you put on your shoes? Abba Chilkiah says, when I'm walking, I could see where I'm going. I don't need to wear shoes. I could sidestep any hazards. In the water, I don't know what's on the riverbed. So I put on my shoes when I got to the riverbed. Abba Chilkiah, when you got to the thorn bushes, you lifted up your tunic, exposing your legs to get scratched. So what does Abba Chilkiah say? My legs will heal if they get cut. My tunic will not heal if it rips. Abba Chilkiah, why is it that when you got to the edge of the city, ultimately your wife came out to greet you all made up and all dressed? So that I should not want or lust for any other woman. Right? His wife always made herself look attractive for him, so that he should never be tempted by any other woman. Why is that we came to the house? Right? Your wife went in first, you went in second, and you only let us come in third. He said, because I don't know you guys. And as such, I was not going to let you go into the house after my wife. They then go on a little bit more. So he explains, and again, there are more things in the story that we're not going to get into. He then explains other things that occurred over the course of the meal. What's the point? Well, one more piece. So Abba Chilkiah, why is it that we noticed, okay, you and your wife went upstairs to the attic, you went to one corner to daven, she went to another corner to daven. We noticed that the rain clouds came from her direction, not from your direction. So apparently, her prayers carry more weight than yours. Why is that? So which Abba Chilkiah says, because when a poor person shows up at my doorstep, I give him a dollar, I give him a coin. My wife gives the paupers food. She gives them something that provides immediate gratification for their impoverished state. I give them money, and because of that, she has greater merit than me. So let's take a step back. So remember again, David HaMelech says, if someone wants to go ahead and have a committed relationship with God, what does it require? Poel Tzedek. Who's an example, ultimately, again, of Poel Tzedek, one who works with righteousness or justice? Abichilkiah. So what does King David mean when he says Poel Tzedek? He's talking about someone who lives life with a seder. There's an order. My actions are thought out. My day is planned out. I'm not living life by the seat of my pants. But every single thing that I do is mesudr. It has a seder. It has an order. King David is extolling the virtue of being an orderly, well thought out, well planned, and well executed, or I should say a person who lives a well executed life. King David says, do you know why in life so many of us do not gain proper traction? Because we don't have a plan. Because we go ahead and simply, you know, we all know this. You could have a very busy day and accomplish absolutely nothing. We know this because most of us spend a good part of our week exactly like this, right? You begin the day, you make the list, the 10 things you're going to accomplish today. Day goes by and what? One of them I knocked off. One of them I checked off. But one second, I wasn't playing golf. I wasn't staring out at the harbor, right? It was a busy day. You could be busy with a ton of things and yet not move yourself forward at all. If you want to accomplish things in life, you have to have a plan. You have to have a vision. You have to have a seder. You want to live on the mountain of God, to dwell in God's tent? You have to be a Poel Tzedek. You have to be someone not just who executes righteously. Poel means work. Tzedek means justice, logic, correctness. Be someone who doesn't just work hard. Be someone who works smart. I'm going to expound this just in a moment, but here's what's amazing. Where does King David get this from? Where does he really get this from? Whether he knew it or not, he got it from his grandmother Rus. Because what was it about Rus that caught Boaz's eye? And remember again, the fact that she catches Boaz's eye, you know how the story ends. She marries Boaz. They have a child. They begin the Davidic messianic line. All why? Because Boaz was taken not by her looks. Boaz was a very beautiful woman as well. But Boaz was taken. I've never seen someone so well thought out. Can you imagine what it must have looked like in biblical Israel in the fields of the rich? Can you imagine? Right? You think driving in Israel is bad? Right? Imagine what it was like in the fields. It must have been crazy. Right? Because think about it. There's a limited amount of produce. There's a large number of impoverished people. Probably people running everywhere, grabbing anything they could get their hands on. And here in the midst of all of this chaos is a woman who is living a well-executed, well-thought-out, well-planned, mesudr life. Two stalks, not three. It's tsanua, it's modest here to bend down, it's modest here to stand up. I'm going to go to the far end before I pick anything up so I don't have to schlep everything around the field. In the midst of all of this chaos, what catches Boaz's eye more than anything was her sense of tzedek. Here is a well-executed, well-thought-out, meticulous, and orderly young woman. That is not a midah. That is not an attribute that you find too often in this world, and certainly not an attribute that you often find in younger people. For most of us, it takes us a while to hone in on this skill. Go down a number of generations, and King David says, what is the key to spiritual success? What is the key ultimately, again, to living on the mountain of God, dwelling in the tent of God? Poel Tzedek. Like who? Like Abichilkiah. Live life with a vision. Live life with a plan. Make sure everything you do makes sense. And if it doesn't make sense, don't spend your time, energy, and resources accomplishing it. The truth is, we learn this concept even earlier on in the Torah. Just end this, with this I'll conclude. If you remember again, going back to the story of Joseph and his brothers, Yosef and the brothers. So remember again, the Torah opens up that there's incredible familial discord. The brothers really don't like Yosef, that's putting it mildly. And he tells them the dreams, they dislike him even more. So the brothers are out tending to the flock, out in the middle of the field. And what happens? Jacob sends Joseph, to go check on his brothers. So Joseph can't find them. So the Torah records an exceptionally enigmatic episode. Joseph is lost in the field, right? Vayimtzeihu ish v'nitoa basada. A guy, a man, finds him, and Joseph is lost in the field. And the man asks Joseph a very simple question. Two-word question. And the words are, ma tivakesh. What are you looking for? What are you looking for? And Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, explains so beautifully that he was asking Joseph much more than just like, are you looking for someone? This was an incredible foreshadow. Joseph, you are about to be cast into a set of tumultuous circumstances. The rug is about to be pulled out from under you in such a dramatically overwhelming way. You're going to become a slave. You're going to rise to a viceroy. You're going to live in palaces. You're going to live in dungeons. If you want to be successful in life, you have to ask yourself one question. What do you want from life? What do you want to accomplish? Who do you want to be? What is the metric of success for your life? If you can answer that question, then no matter what life throws your way, you'll be just fine. If you can't answer that question, then every curveball throws you for a loop. Then every tidal wave pulls you under. That's what Abba Chilkiah was teaching us. That's what Paul Tzedek. That's what King David was teaching us. And that's what King David's great-grandmother Ruth was teaching us. If you want to be successful in life, you have to have a plan. We read the book of Ruth on Shavuos for a variety of different reasons, but one of them is because we celebrate on Shavuos the fact that we receive the Torah. Torah is the greatest tool we have for life success. But you can only be successful in life if you have a plan. Do you know how many of us go through life? And you ask a person, do you have a plan? Sure, I have a plan. I have a meeting at 8 o'clock, right? A conference call at 9. I have to go shopping today. I have a little league game today. No. Not a plan for today. Oh, you mean a plan for the week? Sure. This week I have to accomplish A, B, C. No. Not a plan for the day and not a plan for the week, but a plan for your life. What do you want to accomplish in your life? And it's shocking to see how many of us can't actually answer that question. If you were to go ahead and leave this room today and be stopped, someone to ask you, what do you want to accomplish in your life? And you can't give fluffy answers like make a difference in the world, right? Or be holy. You got to give real answers. What is going to be, if God were to take you out of this world today, would you have lived an accomplished life? Or what do you need to accomplish in this world before leaving this world? Serious questions that, what is my plan? What do I have to do? And the scary part is, again, so many of us have not really thought through the answer to that all-important question. Rus teaches us, live life with seder, live life with order. Before you do something, make sure you're doing it for the right reasons and it's the right thing to be doing. Make sure all of your actions could stand on their own and are meaningful and make sense. You take the actions, and then what does Gabi Chilkiah builds on that? Make sure the way you live your day ultimately makes sense. Make sure the things that you're doing are the things you should be doing and spending your time on. And then King David takes the lesson of his grandmother, the lesson of Abba Chilkiah, and builds on it even a bit more. Poel Tzedek. You want a relationship with God? You want to live in the tent? You want to dwell on the mountain? Make sure your life is purposeful. Make sure your life has meaning. Make sure that you have a plan. This is the essence of Shavuos. God gives us a Torah, but the Torah is only a tool. And like any other tool, the tool is only good if you know how to use it. You can have the most incredible set of craftsman tools, but if you are handy challenged like myself, that tools will sit in your closet until someone who knows how to use them comes over and fixes whatever needs fixing. God gives us the tools on Shavuos. He just asks us to make the plan to know how to properly use them. first apple beer. Thank you.
We want to thank Rabbi Silber. If you'd like to have a follow-up, please feel free to send your plans in an email.